Good morning, gentlemen.
Why do we go from one thing to another? Why did you hit send on an email just before you walked in, and I did the same thing before I walked in? Why do we do that to ourselves?
That's such a good question. It's almost like I think we have this gene in ourselves, like get everything done before the next thing. I don't know what it is. I think I got it from my... It's a trauma related thing.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean,
because it's like urgency. It's like Christmas. It's like, oh fuck, I want to do everything now.
Yeah.
I don't know what we were talking about. That you said, yes, to your wife, to your partner, relax.
Let's just slow it down.
Let's slow it down. You know,
2 weeks to go. Let's land this plane. Okay.
And it's a December thing, maybe, or it's a life thing. Oh. It's maybe an age thing. I don't know. What do you think?
I think we have our past selves to blame, you know, ourselves from 6 months ago who made all these commitments in the future, in the short-term future, that have now come back to haunt us.
Maybe I'm lacking some boundaries. I've got to say no more.
Oh, I've been told I lack boundaries. Yeah.
Yeah, well,
by a number of people, actually.
My partner does boundary workshops, so you could talk to her.
Oh, yeah. Please introduce me. I should have said by a number of qualified people who are qualified to tell me that I lack boundaries. It's so nice to meet you.
Yeah, pleasure. Ooh. It's good. Well, I heard lots about you. So
I heard lots about you.
This good man, he's been in my field for decades now.
How did you both meet?
That's a very good question, Jim. And I've been reflecting on this question because I need to paint a picture of this magnificent human that's sort of sitting with us. And look, I talk about people that come into your world and can change your life with a few words. And this man is one of those. I mean, I met Gilbert about just over two decades ago with a mutual friend, Murali. And Murali and I were sort of doing some design work for I think it was the Center for Sustainability around implementing change. And I meet this gent. He's got this magnificent yellow mohair scarf. I think he had this tartan suit on, Gilbert. You probably remember one of those. And I thought, who is this dude? This guy is just, he has got such a big personality. And I recall you told this kind of story, and I was on this kind of journey where, you know, who am I? What am I about? You know, what's this thing called purpose? And you wrote this little sort of infographic on this piece of paper. I don't know if you remember that. And it was like something around the hero's journey saying, mate, you're on this journey, you're on this quest, and you'll get this gift. And this gift will come and help you along on your journey. And, mate, I have had so many gifts since that time, mentors, door openings. And I think something Gilbert reminded me of is we're always – I know we're getting right into it. Can we get right into
it?
Yeah, you can. Okay. So, we always get these gifts and these spontaneous openings, and Gilbert reminded me of that. And I think your mentorship and Murali's mentorship and guidance, because I was a younger guy, it's – they just – these beautiful humans, like you, they just accelerate what you do. So, I'm deeply humbled to have you here.
Oh, thank you. It's beautiful. Thank you.
Was that a good story?
That's beautiful. Like
that?
I can't remember.
What did you draw? You can't remember.
I do remember the story, though. Yes. And I do remember meaning. I do remember writing that,
yes,
you know, the Joseph Campbell circle of the hero's journey, which effect, you know, someone shared with me, so it's not, yes, original. I just happened to say, well, you're doing the same gig that I did a decade before, back in the early 90s, you know. You know, finding allies, saying yes and take deep diving, and, you know, you're in the belly of the whale.
Yes.
It could be a dark night of the soul, but these dark nights of the soul do give gifts. The gifts could be something you won't even expect in life, you know. So I think those sort of things, I saw it in you anyway, yes, ultimately. You can see someone who's curious and who wants to know a little bit more, you know. So it was just a point in your journey, right? And then that gift is another calling. I think, yeah, I remember saying, you've got to, yes, give this, you got to go share this gift.
Yes.
You can't keep this gift to yourself. Mm. And, you know, the world needs your gift.
Yeah.
So I think you're doing your gig.
Yeah. No, mate, Jim, it just really opened me up.
That's
wonderful. And it just, you know, when you have this experience, I remember walking out of that going, man, I just want to run down the street and go, come on, let's do this.
Can you talk to us about that day? Can you just dive into it a little bit?
Well, I you know, and Murali was another gift that presented in my world who really opened me up to the world of change and human change and transformation. And both Gilbert and Murali also opened me up to what's now known as Bohmian dialogue, sort of this art of story, Jim. You know, it's kind of, I guess, you know, a lot of the foundation stuff we do in Fearless Conversations, which is everyone's talking at everyone, but no one's really creating space opening dialogue and opening up that beautiful meaning-led narrative around, fuck man, what actually matters to you? What's going to sing deep in your heart and your soul? What are you here to do? And that sort of beautiful meaning-led journey is I guess both Morley and Joubert really opened up that foundation a few decades ago, and that's been invaluable. So I'm just so rapt to have you here today.
Cool, that's great. Good to be here.
Was that what kind of work were you doing back then?
At the time, I had a couple of projects. A few years before, I was a general manager at Chadston, so we created the fashion capital. Mm. It was all good fun, and went to Mall of America, the biggest shopping center in the world, and traveling the world. And I was only 26, so I was very young to be in that position. Mm. 27, and then I had an epiphany, and as you do, when you know, you fall in love, your partner says no. You get a broken heart. Mm. Then I had this epiphany after swimming with wild dolphins. I know all this happened very quickly. And in this epiphany, Jim opened up this whole, again, the hero's journey happened, where I'd resigned, went into the boardroom and said, I didn't say I swam with the dolphins, but I basically, John Gandil would have freaked out. Mm. But I just went into a different direction and I just trusted that process. Where I was given a job within 5 minutes, like, can you do the vision for Queen Victoria Market
and create this?
So, because they knew that what Chadston was doing, they needed some skill set. So at least that opened a door. But that opened up the sense of place and community. And then within a year within that, we opened up two organisations. One was the first ethical business foundation in Australia called EPOC. Mm-hmm. And that was about, you know, business as a force for good. And the triple and quadruple bottom line. We were even talking about spirituality in business then. And Murali was a co-director. And I think that was pretty profound. And the other group we created, and that's what happens, I suppose, when you, the road less traveled, was Spiral Connection, which at the time in Melbourne was full of alcohol, drugs, just dance parties that weren't very healthy and safe, especially for women. So we opened up the first dance party that was drug, alcohol, smoke-free, which was pretty radical at the time. Like, hundreds of people turned up every month for 7 years.
Wow.
And we had 50 African drummers, and we had ritual. And we started to allow what I call that sense of deeper connection to the larger self through dance, through the celebration of the sacred, through ritual, community ritual, which we've lost now, you know, gathering together. And we're in need of new rituals. So that was beautiful because it allowed people to feel safe in a place, to get out of their heads. Other cultures have intelligence through somatic experience, the body, dance and ritual and stillness, and drumming is such a powerful. Mm. And we had five rhythms. We introduced five rhythms to Australia, which is a practice. So that was amazing. So those two things lasted for 7 years. So, and then at the same time, Village Well was created when I left Chadston. So I just knew that some of this smart commerce had to go and protect our towns and main streets, because they were being eaten up by consumption palaces, big shopping centres, which people don't really get in the world, the importance of local villages and communities and public space until it's gone. And then we get sick, because 50% of our mental and physical health is around our built environment.
It's crazy, isn't it? The average punter wouldn't even get their head around that.
No. Of course, greenery. Well, good old COVID said that. Five things happened during COVID that made our work more evidence-based was the importance of nature.
Yes.
Greenery. The importance of public space, parks, streets and the importance of localism, local shops, and the importance of community.
Mm.
You know, suddenly it's not about just me locked away in a room. I need community, you know. And then I think that last one was really, obviously the changing nature of work shifted in the most profound way in history, which will never go back to what it was. Mm. And that's another discussion. But the last one is that sense of meaning.
Hmm.
People started discovering there's something bigger. And obviously there was tree change and sea changes out of that. A million Australians did that, which is quite profound, in a level of 5 months, unseen before. But I think underneath that was people are questioning a system that's not healthy.
That just doesn't feel right.
Like if you call it capitalism or extreme growth or whatever you want to call it, it's sucking our life force.
Mm-hmm.
It was doing that slowly, but I think it's been speeding up in the last decade. And now I think with the crazy cost of living, and housing is a barbecue stopper, it never was. But because rich people's kids can't get a house, now it's a barbecue stopper.
Yeah, that's it.
Hello.
Yeah, now it's a problem.
A middle class. It's a problem now. You know, our kids will never be able to own a house in a city or middle ring city. They'll have to go out somewhere or the bank of mum and dad.
Mm.
And not every Australian will going to have that,
especially
my cousins in Dandenong.
Yes.
Or elsewhere. And so I think now, that's a long-winded answer, Jim, but those things catalysed. Like, what is a story for our city, really, we were interested in? Can we make it safer? Can we make it more vital and vibrant? Can we make it more just?
Yeah,
Can business can be play a part in this, the private sector, instead of making them the bad guys? Can consumers become citizens again, which is not even part of their DNA at the moment? We're just so sophisticated in transactions, but not relational piece, you know, connection. Mm.
Jim, you know, one thing Gilbert you've always done so well is you just know how to handle polarity and division without getting lost. And I know you and I caught up a little while back and we're chatting about the need for people to just sit in the middle of polarity and division without getting hooked into the black and white thinking. Is that something you've always had as a philosophy? Where did that kind of, you know, that compassion to sit in any space start for you?
Well, I think, God, it's pretty extreme now, isn't it? We're in worlds of binary now. Yeah. It's like you can't say anything unless you say one word and you're over there and I'm over there. So I think what the world needs now is those bridges of new language and new connection. And I think, how do we actually have the skills to really listen and collaborate and hear difference and sit in the fire of difference and be curious around difference, not to judge. You know, because my name is Gilbert or Gil, or I've got this skin colour, or I dress a certain way, or I believe in this, to be more curious. We've lost our sense of civic respect and conversation.
So true.
So I think we're going to need some civics education back, I think, somewhere down the line. I mean, it does start with mum and dad.
Yes. Mm.
But ultimately, you know, in the world of social media and everything else, it's so extreme. So I think it's come from a place where being a Creole, which I'm African, Indian, French, grew up in social housing, you sort of know you're an edge dweller already, and you're going to know, and I've been privileged and humbly given opportunities to step into positions of possible influence, so I can have that level of responsibility to create those bridges.
Yes.
And then we've tried to do that with the private sector so they can be a force for good. That was the Epoch story. So the big guns, private sector, you know, working in those areas, they can feel like, oh, we're the big bad cops. But they can be, I'm talking small C capitalism and big C capitalism.
Mm.
So I think the skill sets has been for me is to do it's been an inside job. I've had to go inside and really work on myself. And that's a big story in itself, but that's where I think it's all about. How do you work on your own self-awareness to be sitting in difference and sitting in the fire? And I know one of my teachers said, you know, every time you're going to be in a room with difference, you're going to burn your own wood.
Mm.
You're going to burn your ego.
Mm.
You're going to burn, you know, the things that is going to stop you from reaching out. You've got to go beyond that and build, hear, connect. It's not an easy thing to do. I still get triggered by my partner. She's a gorgeous human being, but great.
Yes.
But you got to live. You got to turn up,
and
you got to be conscious in that when you turn up, right? So that's an everyday, that's an every moment gig.
Yeah. Can you tell us about the epiphany you had? You mentioned you had an epiphany. Was that a moment? Was that a series of events? Are you still having that epiphany?
Good question, Jim. I think the epiphany was, especially with the swim of the dolphins, I quickly wrote, you know, my intentional purpose in life. That was a big thing even to say that at the time was, and I wrote down on a piece of paper, is to open the hearts and minds of humanity to a life nourishing story. That's a big statement. So I just knew that the system was extracting. I didn't understand the complexities of that, but I knew that if I could think about my actions, and it was never 100% gig, could I nourish life? So that's driven like a moral compass in the background, and it's still working now. Like even my organisation, Village Well, has been repositioned as a regenerative practice now. We realised 6 years ago sustainability is not going to cut it anymore.
Yeah.
What are we sustaining in a climate change, climate emergency? We're already in it.
Mm-hmm.
And it was 40.
Well, four beyond it.
Yeah, it was 44 degrees in Western Sydney yesterday.
Wow.
Like in the beginning of December, like what's that about?
Yeah.
Mm. People dropping off and extreme heat fires everywhere. So I think that epiphany starts to, it's sort of like an embedded in your system. I did have a teacher that gave me epiphanies at that time as well. Called Joanna Macy.
Mm-hmm. What was she about? What was her sort of?
Well, I was looking for a story at the time, and that sort of made sense of the world, as you do, and I couldn't find it. There was lots of stories, but there were sort of greenwashing, and it was all like, this doesn't sit in your gut.
Yeah.
So her story was an introduction around deep ecology. So that was really about a systems view of the world, that all life was radically interconnected. Other species have a right to be here. I didn't even get that. Nature is a living organism. This is, you know, back in the early 90s, the Gaia theory. And but also she introduced me to the concept of, you know, we're living in a time of the Anthropocene. It's a slow death of our biosphere. I did not even get that until now. Like, we're in it now, but that was 33 years ago. So I think that started to do that catalyzed a lot of grief in me. But that her work is based on grief and empowerment, which we so basically despair and empowerment. If we don't go into the despair, we'll never get the fire of change.
Yeah, right.
Sure, positivity. So if I understand it correctly, she helped you understand that your time is finite and so is the community's.
That's right.
You know, in that's the grander right. scheme of things.
That's right, yeah.
We're in the middle of it.
Humans, on the geological clock, modern humans came 2 seconds to midnight.
That's right, yeah.
2 seconds.
Yes, literally.
Yeah.
Literally, and you know, we're a tenth of a second right now, and we're definitely at 1 minute to midnight around climate change. Like, there's, you know, so what do we do? So these are the big questions for our time, really, isn't it? What are we to do? What am I to do in this time? So that epiphany still holds true. And I think, you meet other people along the way.
That's right. And I imagine, just going back to that epiphany, you met your teacher, your mentor, did you say?
Yes.
Meeting those people gives us the vocabulary to understand what we're going through, doesn't it?
It's absolutely.
Almost, you know, it wasn't the dolphins, but the dolphins was a trigger.
Because it was just nature, really.
It was all already in you.
I think so.
You were probably already having that epiphany within you anyway, somehow, subconsciously. But these moments were like triggers, and then a human comes across and acts as a beacon almost, doesn't it? And a mirror. And like you said, a teacher that gives you vocabulary and the language to understand what you're going through. They're important people, aren't they?
Absolutely. And I think we underestimate how important these people are on the journey of life. And I think, you know, they also give you the responsibility. They're not just going to give you this information.
And accountability.
And accountability. Mm. Like, oh, you know, we sit on the shoulders of elders that have come before us. And, you know, wisdom, you know, knowledge is applied wisdom. So I think how do we put that and share it? You know, the gifting economy. How do we... people would... I think, well, I've been very fortunate. I've attracted many good things in my life through the process of gifting.
How so?
Tithing and gifting. Like, I'm always helping, mentoring young people or helping Indigenous groups or setting up the Epoch Foundation just recently. You know, we gift a lot of time for public service and public outreach around education and so I think all of these things make us who we are. As long as you've got enough And that's a big question. How much is enough? And you don't want to get, you're going to want to chase the next investment property. You've got time to give back or whatever. So I think, those mentors, and there'll be more mentors. So I've now turned 60. I feel like I've got to give back.
Mm.
So that's why Epochs, the institute, has been set up with a bunch of other 60-year-olds.
Yeah.
So we're all talking about, okay, we had a good, we're probably the blessed ones. The next generation will have to sort of battle other battles, bigger ones and possibly than what we've had ecologically and economically. And
so true.
So here we go. Hold on for the ride.
Here we go. Welcome to the roller coaster.
Why do you think we've lost the ritual within community? Why do you think we're in Melbourne? Are you speaking about our city or you think generally?
Yeah, Melbourne stands out in some unique places in spaces, but I think generally, if you look, I use the term, when I ask the comment, I've worked with 2,000 cities over 30-odd years, and I ask the question to every community and that I turn up to, what's your favourite place that you've ever visited? Mm. 95% of the time, it's a place that was designed and built pre-1945. That says a lot, I think. Mm. And when you dig a little bit deeper, they go, oh, what do you like about it? Oh, yeah, we just sat down. We watched people go by. We had a coffee. You know, we're in the piazza over there. Oh, we're in the street. It was street life. Oh, was there any cars? Oh, not really. And, you know, oh, you know, it was green. It was beautiful art. The buildings were beautiful. Mm. So I think there's a dozen other elements to that. But I think when we create, in our primal sense, in that time, we're all together, you know. Everything wasn't planned out. So this concept called modernism came in.
Mm.
So suddenly it wasn't about the village anymore. It was about efficiencies. Let's put the hospital over there, the school over there. You can work an hour away. Let's put the shopping centre over there, commuting, stress. Mm. No intergenerational family.
Yes.
That was one of the biggest health determinants we found. Having family close.
Absolutely, yeah.
We lived in a village for, you know, 30,000 years. Mm. And it's only the last 100 years with modernism, with, you know, cars, shopping, planning. We've planned out.
Yeah.
It's transactional and it separates us. Mm. So we've been masters of separating the humans from what matters.
Yeah, and it sounds like it's a city, the modern city is built around the 9 to 5 clock.
Pretty much.
Mm.
Pretty much. And I think that 9 to 5... is only a new construct, you know, in the last couple of 100 years.
Yeah.
So before we lived off the land, of course, you know, we're not going to go back to the old agricultural
farm
roots.
Farm village.
Your great-grandfather, back in the jungle. Yeah. But I do think there's a distinct sweet balance that of a new hybrid work-life balance that's come emerging and new concepts of, dare I say, how we value work and how we value life. And I think people have just they're on the tipping point now. You can feel it. We're all suffering from low-level trauma. There's even a word globally now called solastalgia. Mm. It's a new word in the English language. It's only 10 years old. It was born out of Newcastle because of the coal, biggest coal.
Mm. Wow.
They found everyone was suffering from some low-level trauma. They couldn't see a bright future. Mostly young people are suffering from solastalgia because they can't see.
Yeah, have that change. Hope.
There's
have
no hope.
Yes.
So they're in deep despair. So I think we need to quickly work out, the active hope model or the story that's going to keep people. We're going to lose stuff, but how do we move forward that we can create that level of the new story? Yeah. That will nourish life.
Yeah. Which city has 2,000 cities? Impressive. Which city, world cities, left a lasting impression on you?
What a great question. Well, being born in Mauritius, Port Louis is one of my favourite places because it's an old colonial city from the 1700s, 1800s, because of the market, the seaside. You know, all the civic infrastructure in there, and it's just street life. It just pours out. Mm. Little Chinatown, little India, little Muslim town.
Yeah.
It just like it's, you know, it feeds you.
Mm.
So obviously I love the food there. It's food is everything because it's food's on the street. So, and, you know, they've got the European piazzas and models of, but because of its multiculturalism, it blows your mind away.
Yeah.
And I do love my city, Melbourne. You know, worked on the laneways renewal, creating the night markets, recreating Melbourne Central, convinced them to put laneways in the development and all, and, you know, activating the Yarra Precinct and closing Swanson Street to trade. All those projects we worked on have created some ripple effect in the early 90s to what it is now. So I think it had the DNA, and it's become a progressive city through its built form. And it's multicultural educational platform, you know. It's a university city in one way as well. So I think we're very lucky in Melbourne to have this. That's why it was voted 7 years. But I'm not a big fan of
those kinds of ratings sort of competitions.
But it's about how people live in a place.
Yes.
It's a city of villages. It suffered through COVID. But I think, you know, I love being French, African and Indian. I think, you know, I still love, you know, Lyon and Paris, those cities, all pre-1945. You know, there is one place that's I feel a little bit proud that we worked on it, called Rouse Hill. It was built 20 years ago. Wow. So that was through a company called Lendlease and GPT, who owned Melbourne Central. Anyway, cut a long story short, they created the centre as a piazza. It was an open-air shopping centre. They created a community hub, a library, a secret garden, a main street, 400 apartments, co-working. That was ahead of its time 20 years ago, but it's thriving, and was the only place that thrived during COVID in the suburbs because it was outdoor.
Yes.
Because the shopping centre's closed, remember? So if we have another pandemic, which...
It's quite inevitable. It's inevitable.
With you know, the biological collapse, things will start to get sick. So those things can be... We can create new things that are good. That's what I suppose.
When you conceive of these ideas, I know you're really awesome on, I guess, this craft of visioning. Do you want to tell us about how that happens for you? I guess you either have to create a vision or collaborate with others to create a vision? Because I think it's... You talk about hope, it's important for us and people listening to this podcast. Like, how do you actually take that hope and transform it into a vision? Where does that start for you?
Yeah, well, I think I have a little saying, where there is vision, the people flourish.
Yes.
Where there's no vision, the people perish.
Okay.
I took that out of the Bible, actually. It was a good, you know, was Catholic boy. But... You know, I think we're living in a crisis of imagination.
Yeah.
You know, even with Epoch, our positioning line in Epoch is reimagining people, place and planet. Yeah. We need to reimagine and be bold in this time. And I think working with our private clients and public clients and even not-for-profit groups and little main streets and small towns, we have to frame it at what's happening in this time. So the visioning process is really critical. It has to be three things. It has to be uplifting and inspiring. Yeah. It has to be enabling with a level of ownership.
Yeah.
And it has to be doable.
Yes.
So those three things are very rare around what we call that regenerative. We're very strategic now because it's quite a political, moral narrative. We throw the regenerative wherever we can. Can this vision nourish life? Can this be regenerative? You know, we need to educate and uplift our clients at this time, because business as usual is not, you know, it's not going to work. So I think that concept, the two principles of great visions for us as a placemaker or regenerative practitioner now, is that the wisdom lies in the community. We've forgotten that principle. You know, I can be an expert. I've got 1,000,000,000 ideas. I can go, look at this. I've got a prediction. I've got blah, blah, blah. But that 5 or 10% of the magic comes from the ground up, the bottom-up approach.
Yeah,
they know what's really important. We've got to deeply hear and listen to the Indigenous people, the land, the young people, all the ones who won't turn up to the boardroom or the workshop or the town hall meeting. Go to them and do the walk, the beat. Do a workshop of the town. Don't Don't do a workshop or visioning. Walk the site. Walking, yeah. Sit under a tree, which we did in the Kimberleys for 3 days with the elders.
Wow.
And let it emerge. Mm. If we've lost the concept of emergence, it's got to be...
Yeah.
It's fast money. Time is money.
Yeah.
So that's a trick because the client wants it quick. And then I think the second phase of that is allowing a deeply creative process of immersion where we allow the arts to come into it, to draw, to dream, to move, and to present back. Let the community present back. So when they present back, they own it. They get excited. And then I think the last piece, and this is the process question, is about how do we synthesize all that together. We always get a few community allies, zealots, leaders who can be articulate, and they're the ones who can, they need to take ownership of that wisdom. So they articulate back some of that, and we just craft it, but they own it. And it's always about small wins. Some of these visions can be quite bold and nothing happens, but how do we, in the first week, month, 6 months, 3 months, do a whole heap of small activations, plant flowers, paint the building, create a bit of art, you know, change our physical landscapes quickly, or put on a festival, whatever it is.
And so how do you do that? Sorry, did I cut you off?
No, go
there?
For it.
How do you do that with the NIMBY mindset?
Well, that's the biggest movement in town at the moment because, you know, and it's all based on fear because I want to keep my quarter acre backyard. Mm. I want quiet. Mm. So I think what we're seeing on the contra trend is like the INBY movement, in my backyard.
Yeah, right.
They've started, mostly driven by young people in inner Melbourne suburbs because they want affordable rental and affordable apartments. Mm. And they want to live with high amenity. Now, there's a double edge to this with the inner ring and middle ring suburbs of Melbourne, which is mostly where there are. You don't see them in Dandenong and, you know, in Geelong or Ballarat, but it's mostly in more middle to high income suburbs. I think what's going to happen now is two things. One is that how do we educate this community and engage them in an authentic way and tell them a narrative? And then they won't get full buy-in, but you're going to have to engage deeply. And that narrative is about amenity and quality of life because they all want good coffee, great food.
Yes.
They want entertainment now. So this is the baby boomers who are coming in, mostly are the NIMBYs. That generation before, slowly in their 80s and 90s now, but it's the next generation in their 60s and 70s, the baby boomers, So we've got to really sell that amenity because they're going to be selling their homes into smaller.
Yeah.
And they want in my backyard.
Yeah, that's right.
So that's where we're moving towards, and that's going to transform. Government may have to step up, like in Europe, and do an overlay. What's happening in England, I think, inclusionary zoning, we only have 5 to 10% of affordable housing in developments. In England, it's 40%.
Wow.
No wonder they can afford, you know, they put affordable housing. We should be having that level, at least 15, 20.
My mind's going to homelessness, right, and which is the complete other end of the spectrum from the Chadstone fashion capital, right? The 5 to 10% is such a small margin, such a small space to operate in, isn't it? And then we have this enormous homelessness issue that is just getting worse. How do you consider that in your visioning of a place?
Yeah, look, it's such a complex issue and problem, and it's been around for a long time, but it's just gone quantum in the last decade for various reasons around cost of living. We're starting to see middle-class homelessness now. Mm. The highest homeless growth in Australia that we work with is women over 50 who are now homeless, women over 50, which is it's just extraordinary. They're in their cars, you know, they're full of shame and trauma and fear. It's just not right. So I think how do we work with that is like we don't have the silver bullet, but we do work with housing providers like Haven, Launch Housing, which we did Viv's Place, which just won awards around the world, and we should have 100 of these. And these were places where for women escaping extreme, who are homeless, women escaping extreme violence, and women over 50 who are homeless. Yeah. So suddenly they're together and You know, we're creating these environments where look, at the bottom line is that it's cheaper to the government to buy an apartment to get care, you know, provide care for each of these individuals, feed them, then have them on the street and let the cost of policing, the cost of, you know, hospitalisation, the cost of a whole heap of other services. And we've seen this in the States, where I can't remember the city, who is the only city that's actually fixing homelessness in America. It's one of the southern cities. I'm not sure if it's Dallas or it's in Texas. I'll remember it. But they've experimenting with basically of making sure that each person has an apartment, has a home. Yeah, it's the number one determinant of safety, of health, and of healing. As long as they've got those services. Someone's watching them, checking on them. So as a society, I'm a big fan of, like, we need to do that.
I think I read about that, actually. The city name is on the tip of my tongue. They gave them an apartment, gave homeless people an apartment and cash. And it was a social experiment a few years back. And they spent the cash on quality of living, because the assumption was they would spend it on something else. And the assumption was shattered. It was really just on the tip of my tongue what that city was.
That's right. And I think that's the sort of thinking we need.
Absolutely. It was very disruptive at the time. And I don't think everyone on council agreed with it, that program. But it was very successful.
Absolutely. Mm. And we need to be bold. And I think there's plenty of evidence from an economic point of view. Mm. That's what we need to do. And so that evidence-based sort of framework. But what we need is also public education.
Yeah.
That we, you know... that's the stigma. What they, you know, people with homelessness just live with stigma and shame, and it shouldn't be the case, because a lot of them are middle class who are dropping out at the moment. And so I think it's housing is the big issue in our country right at this moment, and homelessness and affordability for young people are the twin pillars, I think, that need to be the focus.
Something you do, Joubert, right now, and you do this sort of naturally, is you've got this ability to tell these heartfelt stories. How important is it for people just to learn and build that craft to be able to embody a story? You embody it. It's coming through you. It's not in your head. It's just like your whole body's moving at the moment. I mean, where did you sort of learn that? Or how did that sort of, was that something that you just kind of, when you grew up, is that part of the culture that you're around? Because I've always noticed that with you can tell a story with your whole body, which is going to get people on board that journey, or more likely to.
It helps being Mauritian and having 136 first cousins. Well, that's a good question. I come from a feeling culture that does help, and we sense things.
Yeah.
You know, being born in a village in Mauritius, it's all about the senses, which I think why I'm doing the work that I'm doing. It's about reactivating our senses.
Yeah.
We've been desensitized and become transactional humans, really. Mm. So I think that's just been in me, because I'm more intuitive. Even though, you know, I studied, I did a couple of degrees at Monash, blah, blah, blah. Can't remember what I did. But ultimately, it's an energy, isn't it? It's an energy of wanting to do the right thing, seeing beauty in another person, seeing the possible of that person and their potential, seeing the potential of life, you know. And it's really about energy follows energy. Yes. I've always – and look, my work is not – it's pretty challenging, you know. We might be getting a job in Alice Springs soon, and, you know, I've worked in Alice Springs, and that's just the hardest place probably –
I could imagine.
Toughest place in Australia at the moment, as you probably heard in the last 6 to 12 months. Mm. So ultimately, places like that need deep healing and love and care. And it's not going to be through an intellectual process.
No.
You're going to have to be on the street. Mm. You're going to have to deeply listen. You're going to have to act in a transformative way and practice. 1,000-page master plan's not going to fix
it. It's not going to fix it.
Any place like that. It's going to be like, get together. Get in the environment, let's work together and put the passion into that space and the energy. And I think my thing, you know, what did Joseph Campbell said? It's like, to be human, it's not about, you know, it's not about finding meaning, he said. It's about finding aliveness.
I like that.
I love that.
The vitality, the energy.
You can have a spiritual bypass by finding meaning in life. Yeah. And you see spiritual bypassing everywhere. You know, it's a bit of pop psychology. But for find meaning, it's raw, it's real. You can feel people. That's why I love going to Footscray or I work in St. Albans, you know.
Fantastic.
You go on the streets and,
you see everything. You see the people. You see smell. The kind of the.
It's not sanitised. Yeah. It's real.
People. We grew up in Footscray.
Polished. Well, Footscray. There you go.
David and I grew up in Footscray.
Footscray boys. You know, exactly. No wonder I can smell you. Yeah.
Running from the law.
Yeah. Footscray. It's a wonderful place, Footscray. My father migrated there in the early mid 60s from Greece and still there. He's 89 in a few weeks.
Wow. Bless him.
Yeah, thank you. He's a real treasure. He's an archive of wisdom, which is what our family calls him, our extended family. Footscray is an amazing place, and it is this melting pot of people who bring that awareness to at street level. And that's certainly the Footscray that I grew up in, and also what it is now. It's still that now.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. I think it's just a different... you know, generation of, like in Dandenong, we used to have Italians, Greeks, in the 70s. Now there's Afghans and Muslims, there's, you know, Islanders, but they bring another.
Yeah, that's right.
Level, and Indians energy, you know, and they bring their different smells and foods. And
it's great.
You know, you don't have to travel the world in Australia. You just go to Footscray, Dandenong.
That's right. Two extremes, that's great. And everything in between as well, that's for sure.
That's right, that's right.
I'm interested in your comment earlier about business as a force for good. That's a principle that's really important to me. We're one of Australia's earliest B Corps. I'm passionate about business as a force for good. And I've been asking myself some questions, Joubert, to understand what that actually means and how I think I'm arriving at the conclusion that all businesses must be a force for good. And I'm not saying they need to meet some sort of accreditation criteria, but all businesses must have that level of awareness that you've just described to impact their local communities in a greater way, to also think about their presence within community, the space they occupy, the flow of revenue in and out of the community, the cost and value. Andrew Cairns put it really well in our recent conversation. The value extraction from the community, which a lot of businesses do, yet their ability to then put value back into the community, that circular model that you just described. I think I'm arriving at the conclusion that all leaders and also all businesses must consider themselves in some way as a force for good. Now, good is a spectrum, of course. I'm interested in your thoughts on that, because you mentioned that in the context of EPOC, but also your current organisation is a force for good. And I've known you for 45 minutes, I just looked at the clock, and you're a force for good. How important is that notion to you? And how important is it to your organisation, the functioning, the model, the behaviour, the impact of your organisation?
What a great question. Look, I think if we look at historical, the institution of business and the institution of exchange, really, you know, the market, the old markets, you know, it was always about, you know, you give me something, I'll give you something back. And it was very hyper-local for thousands of years. And it's just recently, and I think, the institution in business really had, in the early days, had to actually have a social license. It actually had to have a physical license. So that's really about the legitimacy we're questioning now. And obviously that changed, and when the laws and the Supreme Court came in, and suddenly they had this, businesses had the same rights as individuals, which changed the world in one fell swoop. Before, they had to come back every year and say, we want a license to trade again. And the community would say, what did you give back? Imagine that was still the case. And we had elder boards and, of course, it wouldn't be that practical. But just that concept, yeah, they just don't have the right to extract everything. They just don't have the right to extract all that social value of roads, rubbish, you know, the airwaves.
Yeah.
They just, it's just, you know, it's like the commons. So they've extracted the commons. So I think if you think of commoning and the protection of the commons and the importance of the commons, of public space and, you know, democracy, you know, you can't have a thriving business without a lively,
vibrant, healthy democratic, community.
Healthy community. You know, you need thriving businesses need that. So, but we need to give back. So I think we've lost that sense of legitimacy. I think we're in that time where the three or four major institutions, their legitimacy for the first time in history have been questioned, and that's, you know, the church, government, and business. That's a huge, you know. So I think that questioning of legitimacy, and I think when I say legitimacy, I think we're talking primarily big business, you know, and big government. So I think small business have already had that sort of social license because they're a face on the ground, right?
Yeah.
You know,
yes.
Peter or Gina or that. They're the shopkeeper. Oh, yeah, don't do that on the street. I'll tell your mum.
Yeah, that's right.
You know? And then you go, oh, you know? So they were looking after the place.
Yeah.
Don't pick up that rubbish. What are you doing? You know? They'd wash their, put a few flowers outside.
Yeah.
You know, water the, you know, the council's tree, whatever it was. You know, give little... You know,
gives them some spare food up the road.
That's sort of a little sweets, and then feed the homeless guy. Yeah. All of those things add up.
Yes.
So I think localism of small business is really the powerful force that's coming through now. I call it glocalism. We're going to always have global, you know, a global economy, but we need a localist anchor in this time. So businesses really can, and we're starting to see the legitimacy being questioned by young people. They will not work for toxic, really clever, young, talented people or just walking away. Where in my generation, we'd stick around for a decade.
You'd just put up with it.
Put up with a toxic.
You'd work for anyone.
That's right. Yeah. And we'd put in crazy hours. Yes. They'd go, no.
Yeah.
We're done. I'm not, look at what happened to my mum and dad. I'm not doing that.
Yes.
Yeah. I'm out of here. So there's a change. It's a change worldview, right?
Very
so business,
much so.
Business have to change.
Yeah. It's certainly not our generation. It's kind of 10 years younger than you. Part of our cohort, let's call it a cohort, it's not a generation. Part of our cohort has wisened up to ethical businesses and ethical behaviours and choices, commercial choices, but most of it has not. But the generations, my children, let's say 17, 14 and 8, they don't see anything but ethical choices in the way when they look at the world. They don't see anything but justice, social justice, fairness, equity, and ethical commercial choices. Now, that's a generational leap from the three of us, right? Huge generational leap. That's a huge change because my three children will be voting soon, and that's a huge change we're going to see in the future.
I agree with you. And I think the millennials in this era, you know, in this Gen Z era that's coming through, they'll be changing every institution and our way of seeing the world. And they'll be coming with much more holistic and integrated worldview that with those twin pillars of social justice and ecological justice. And if you're going to question those two, watch out.
Yes.
And they're going to be absolutely much more savvy than my generation in both politically and spiritually around moral, you know, a moral compass. Yeah. So I think that's a great thing. Bring it on. Bring on the revolution.
Yeah, agree.
Because that needs to be sped up because we're in that birth canal at the moment. We have 5 years roughly to really shift the Titanic. And we, you know, I think that generation and those millennials and Gen Zs are already there.
That's right.
And you know, you can see where they're shopping, what they're doing, and what they're saying, and they've just been, and they have a different level of self-awareness.
That's
scary, you know, which is a good thing. You know, they do. They're even trauma informed.
Yeah.
On one level.
I agree. Yeah,
you know, which is. I wouldn't even know what that word was in Dandenong in the 70s.
Oh, it's a 17-year-old.
I was traumatized by the skinheads and the sharpies running away.
What's getting you up and about, Gilbert, lately? What's sort of what's still driving you? Because you've never been cynical. You've never sort of had that jaded, skeptical kind of view of the world, which can be quite easy for all of us sometimes. But what's sort of what do you think still driving you to push as hard as you ever have with the work that you do?
Wow, look, I think, you know, that youthful energy that comes through, it probably comes from my 98-year-old mother.
So what was she like?
And she's still a dynamo.
Wow.
And still, you know, she'll drink her bottle of whiskey every 2 weeks. She'll buy that, and she's still articulate, brilliant, political, alert. So something definitely shifted my, you know, DNA living with someone like that. And, you know, that's that era from your father. That you know, they came from those depression years. They were localists. Everything counted.
And that's right. War and depression. Yeah,
that's right. Yeah. So I think the question was, like, what's cooking with me what's still happening? I think the answer was I still had that fire in the belly because that intention I wrote 33 years ago, we haven't delivered. Yeah. So, you know, what do you say when you can't? You might even not be delivered in my lifetime, but I'm giving it a good crack.
Yeah.
And I'm going to meet the best good people on that journey, and I might just leave that legacy for the next generation. They'll continue that. I know that. I know this is the next wave. If I can just hold on enough to pass the baton, and create some political new narratives for that change to happen, and be a little bit of an agent provocateur, you know, that creative disturbance, to build those new bridges with my clients, I think that's a really important thing because
I think that's wonderful.
Really, that can be major tipping points. I think the big thing for me is joy.
Yeah.
Let's not forget the greatest human motivator is pleasure. Yes. So for us to, you know, we have always see you have a good laugh, you know, like we're going to have to enjoy the journey along the way. And I think more and more I'm thinking, God, if we're going to do it, at least break bread together. If we're going to do it, let's dance together. Let's just journey together. Let's walk the forest together. Let's get out on the streets. Let's have a, tell me a story, but we'll do the work.
Yes.
There could be the despair, but there will also be the empowerment. There will be the birthing. There will also be the loss. So it's just life doing life. And my probably main driver in this is like, it's like a second, the Indigenous people call it, you know, the second attention. Your first attention is this life, physical body. I'm talking to you now. But I think as you get a bit older, there's like a second attention appears. You know there's something else at work. You know, your intuition and, your sixth sense. So I'm tapping into that a bit more and going with that flow. Sometimes it's really scary, but it's a trust that listening to that intuition, stopping at that synchronicity, acting on that moment, which I used to just walk past, something happens, you know. Where there's an action, there's a reaction. So I think I'm into looking at the field at the moment, and Melbourne has an extraordinary field. I just joined the board of Regen Melbourne.
Oh, yeah. I know Kai.
I know Kai, yeah. So Kai's asked me. It's been great. I haven't been on boards for ages, but I thought this one was great. And I can see what's about to happen. I can be of service again. And I think that regenerative narrative is, and what they're doing is extraordinary work. And it's not just emergent work, it's work that will start to politically shift our thinking and create a new, what I call, moral framework for the city, which is exciting. So if these jobs keep continue, in touch wood, in good health, mind, body, spirit, I think, and I'm very fortunate with EPOC, you know, we've got 10 organisations in EPOC who are just the most profound groups around social justice, ecological justice. So I get to go to a community every day and somehow support them, put on great teachings, like a little wisdom school to share this stuff now and to help the mobilisation. So I think the movement wants to move. We've got to I'd like to find some acupuncture points. For that,
I like that.
To really make it, you know, I can't do much, but at least if I can find a couple of acupuncture points for that change with the right allies, we can do it and then step back. I can't, you know, be the guru, but I can be the, you know, the guy in the background or the foreground helping that. So I'm, you know, that's where I'm at the moment.
It's such a, you know, Jim and I do a lot of work with leaders across various spaces, and, you know, we started, I think, this podcast episode with this deep kind of inner listening, you know, here you got to go inside and do your own housekeeping. And then there's this other thing you just mentioned, which is this, like, it's almost like this subtle thread. It's this subtle thread of meaning, of vitality that's kind of calling you. And sometimes what we do as humans, we shut that down because we're too afraid. We're thinking, fuck, that's going to mean commitment, or I've got to make some changes, or sometimes we don't even hear that. That subtle, it's almost like that subtle thread, that subtle energy. How do we tap into that more, that knowing, that inner knowing, that feel that you talk about? Can you tell us a little bit about that, Gilbert?
Yeah, look, I think, you know, I can only speak from experience. I think for me it's at times different ways. One of them is stopping.
Yeah.
And immersion into silence.
Hmm.
And for me, it's forest bathing. I love to go to the Otways and go to the waterfall and just sit there for an hour, which I just did last week. So those sort of things give me insight.
Hmm.
I think the second one is, and this is different for everyone, community.
Yeah.
Finding the right allies and sitting in community. Another one for me is dance.
Yeah.
I need to move my body. And I think the other one is conscious relationship with another. That's a really powerful, conscious relationship with yourself and with another.
Yes.
So that level of intimacy, which we rarely go to, and truth, telling, and authenticity, and learning skills of how to, you know, sit in the fire, how to repair and reconnect in the moment. We're always going to get triggered in life.
It's just how it is.
It's how it is. Yeah. But sometimes, you know, you just got to sit in that space and understand that this is a moment of healing.
Hmm.
So, you know, we're all wounded healers in a way, you know. I haven't met anyone who hasn't been traumatized this lifetime.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
there's a lot, you know, even the smallest thing, you know, people have their woundings from abandonment and fear or shock or shame or engulfment and engulfing mother or father, whatever it is, there's stuff, right? So we just don't talk about that. So I think for me, probably happened later in life, doing that, the deep inner work, but also expressing and allowing a few people to come into that inner circle. I do a lot of men's group work, you know,
fantastic.
The men's festival that we do every year with 300 men, 200 men, amazing work with Indigenous men, young men.
Tell us about that.
Well, started 10 years ago and I joined the committee. I went to one of the managers and I thought, wow, this is like, how amazing. I've just hung out for a festival called Menergy with a couple hundred guys and we danced together, we ate together. You know, there was 50 workshops on different everything from, you know, get your finance right, have a good relationship with your children or intimacy or let the dragon or whatever dragon. It is, ethical business or blah, blah, blah. And what a good thing because, you know, how to be in a space with other good men.
Mm.
I thought that was a revelation when I first did it and I think we need more of it. The world needs good men.
I so agree. I think I've said that to my close circle so many times that I'm going to look up Menergy. It's right up my alley.
You've got to get there, Jim.
The world does need good men, and that level of awareness that you've spoken to us about is so important to tap into that source that you have been speaking to us about, S-O-U-R-C-E, source, that is so conscious of your legacy. Because we probably won't achieve the great things, the great change that we're trying to achieve in our lifetime. You're right. You know, because people like us have bold and purposeful ambitions. But to be conscious of that and to be conscious of the footprint that you leave is really important, isn't it? And spaces like Menergy, I like that name.
that's right.
You know, men have a role to play in a flourishing future for everyone. And unfortunately, the world is full of child men, for want of a better term. So we need to create spaces for good men to flourish and for men to understand that good manhood is possible.
Mm. Yeah. And it's so important, that space, Jim, I think. Especially the young men in there can see other men. It's like a rite of passage for them, right?
Yeah.
And they just the witnessing of strong men, ethical men, authentic men, vulnerable men, you know, men who see, you know, that vulnerability as a path.
Yeah.
And it's okay.
Yeah. You know, I've been fascinated by, there's a Dr. Arne Rubenstein wrote a book called The Making of Men many years ago.
That's right. That's
right. I read it, my second child was a boy. My son is now 14. I read it many years ago and I was fascinated by the idea of rites of passage and how it's absent, like you said, community and localism is something also that's absent from our society here in the south of Australia. The rite of passage in our culture is sorely missed, but so important, not just for our children, but also for us as men to be conscious of our vulnerability, our masculinity, our power and our weakness, our intimacy, our legacy. So important.
That's right. And I think it's a big thing. Women have done a lot of work on themselves, you know. They've had a movement way beyond us.
Mm.
So I think we're about to see a movement of good men in the next decade.
And I certainly hope so.
And hopefully a revolution. And I think good men need to stand up.
Mm.
They need to step up. They need to, you know, I always say that's like, you know, that warrior within to protect the earth, protect our women folk, protect the most vulnerable. And then we need the lovers, you know, to love the earth, men who are lovers. And we need men who are compassionate and vulnerable. We need men who are magicians who can bring the magic and the mystery back. And we need men who are king, like the benevolent king, who can protect the kingdom. Yeah. So those archetypes of manhood are really, really critical because they create the foundations for the integral man, you know, to be a conscious man. And, and there's humility in that too, right? It's like, it's not your brag, there's no bragging rights about this. It's just holding space, really.
Yeah.
Really just holding space.
Yeah, that's amazing. That's amazing. It's been such a pleasure to meet you.
Fantastic.
Thanks for coming on, Joubert. Really, I've been really looking forward to this. And
good stuff.
I just, you know, just the stories that you tell, the way you turn up, and the way you embody a story, I think there's just the way you actually go deep within and go off. And you spoke about dance and nature and contemplation. You said, this is just how I do it. But I just reckon there's universal laws in that that everyone can follow. So, you know, you've now triggered me to go, well, what's that little voice inside that maybe I don't create space to listen to all the time? And how do we as humans do that on a daily basis? How do we get up in the morning? Because I just think we have to find these different gears right now. Like, we can't be playing at a base level. We've got to go right in. And that can't be monthly. That almost has to be daily. So you've reminded me, and I think you've reminded a lot of the listeners, and I know, Jim, you all sort of resonate with this, is that quiet space to go inside and just to say, what's that little voice inside of me? And if, what happens if I shut that down? I shut myself down. So, yeah, thank you.
Pleasure. Yeah. It's great to be here.
That's wonderful. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Joubert.
Pleasure.
Thanks, Jim.
Hi, I'm Damien Carolla, and I've been playing in the human development and high performance space for a few decades now and run a coaching practice called Mentor Hub. I work with entrepreneurs, athletes, CEOs and leaders on the topics of change and transformation, leadership and culture. What's central to my work is that we create safe, empowering and inspiring spaces for people to realise their potential. And I work with leaders and organisations across a diverse range of sectors, from building, construction and technology through to retail and social enterprise. Now, lately I've been collaborating with leaders and teams around the topics of mental resilience and agility. You know, we use a lot of storytelling, open dialogue to help leaders and teams redefine what it means to build resilience and flexibility across a chaotic world. I believe in the power of the human condition and that Each one of us is here to realise our full potential. And so Fearless Conversations is a series of dialogue sessions where we get to peel back the layers and really explore the things that matter most. It's a conversation between two good friends that care deeply about people and the worlds in which we live.
Hi, I'm Jim Antonopoulos. Actually, my name is Dimitri, but we'll get into that another time. I'm the Managing Director of Strategy and Transformation Consultancy, Tank. We're based in Melbourne, Australia. As one of Australia's earliest B Corp accredited businesses, we work across a number of impact areas on change and transformation programs, empowering young women, sustainable and affordable housing, financial literacy for underrepresented communities, accessible quality education, meaningful workplace cultures, and cultural diversity and inclusion being some of them. My team and I bring empathy and meaning to impact organizations, and we believe that every business and every leader can be good, ethical, and purpose-driven. Or at least they should be. Most importantly, I'm a father of three amazing people, and I work tirelessly to leave the world in a better place for them. Our podcast continues thanks to your support. Listeners like you who have shared our podcast with your networks on LinkedIn and other social platforms have meant the world to us. It has motivated us to continue doing what we do. If you would like to support this podcast and keep it free of advertising forever, please head on over to marchfirst.com.au/podcast, where you can donate to support our show and share the link with your friends and network.